Hello and welcome to MOAS. It's 3 years ago this month since MOAS started operating. It was the first of its kind, a civil society search and rescue mission out to stop the deaths of refugees and migrants compelled to use dangerous sea routes. This is the first part of a two-part podcast that opens up this theme of civil action on the migration crisis. To do this, we'll talk to a number of similar organizations and people helping refugees and migrants. We'll find out what inspired them to do something and what kind of actions they took. First, let me ask you, what do you do when tens of thousands of refugees are traveling through your town, sleeping rough and braving sub-zero temperatures? Well, Refugee Aid Serbia is a grassroots movement of local citizens and organizations that came together in August 2015 to provide aid to the influx of refugees stopping off on the Balkan route. Despite Serbia being a transit country, the work has had to be adaptable to refugees' needs. Here's distribution coordinator Felix Thompson.
So we've now moved as an organisation from our roots in humanitarian aid to expand to educational and recreation activities. So to that aim, we've opened up a dedicated learning centre in Belgrade, in the city centre, which provides a variety of different classes. So we do English language lessons. We are expanding now into maths, science, some basic things around geography. We do, I suppose you could call them maybe basic cultural integration classes. And then on the kind of recreational side of what we do, it's anything from we have in art therapists, we have performance artists, and we're trying to develop some of our schemes to do things such as IT literacy. So it's quite a flexible learning environment. Obviously, the people with whom we work are still considering this a transit country, so it's very hard to develop, let's say, a long-term curriculum with people whose goal is to only stay here for a certain amount of time before they leave. But yeah, we try and make sure that our learning activities reflect their needs, their wants, and their movement, I suppose.
How many people does the organisation help or support?
It would be hard to say an accurate number, unfortunately, because a lot of the activities we do have to be flexible to the extent that, as I say, people will come and go depending on their situation. So the example I gave earlier about our education centre, you know, you can start theoretically an 8-week curriculum, English curriculum, with a family or with a series of students, and then find that 3 weeks in they don't come back in, because eventually they were successful in either finding a smuggler who helped them continue their route, or have gone through one of the other legal means to either be resettled in this country or to go back to their home country for assisted voluntary returns or resettlement in a third country, both of which are very rare. So it's quite flexible. Our centre, I think we're teaching probably between 20 and 30 people a day, mostly regular students. And then, as I say, there's a bit of flexibility in terms of how long people stay. And then our distribution we're doing is less of a prime focus of what we do now than it was before. When there was very large communities sleeping rough still in the city centre, we were giving both food and non-food items to around 1,000 people a day. The government then put in measures that suggested that NGOs should stop providing aid and assistance to refugees who are residing outside of the government camps. So many NGOs curtailed their activities. And about 3 months ago, the informal structures in which a lot of people were still sleeping rough because they had gone inside over the winter here is about minus 15, minus 20 degrees. So a lot of the refugees who've been sleeping in the city centre have been sleeping in these abandoned buildings, warehouses, structures, and those were finally demolished as part of a real estate development project. I think it's about 3 months ago now, at which point everyone was resettled into government camps. So, again, our activities, which were really on the ground here in the city centre, we've now moved to government camps and we're doing distributions in the camps. But today, as a small example, we went to do a distribution in the camp on the northern border with Hungary, and we had been told by the camp authorities that there were 150 people there. By the time we got there was 80, because 80 of them, or the remaining 80 or 70, had either been moved to other camps, had voluntarily left the camps, or, as I say, had continued their journey and had finally left Serbia.
Can you tell me more about the Odyssey project and what it aims to do?
It's a documentary following some of the team from here at Refugee Aid Serbia as we retrace the Balkan route. So we'll be starting in Turkey, going all the way up to Brussels, a kind of symbolic heart of the European Union. And we'll be stopping off in different locations where there are large refugee communities to recreate these roots festivals. So to engage the local population there and the local refugee population in a day's worth of activities. So we're running six festivals. We're doing them in Greece, back here in Serbia, doing them in Vienna, Berlin, Paris, and Brussels. And we're doing them all in collaboration with local NGOs, because obviously we're not on the ground in these places. But over the past few months, we've been speaking to different groups, going down, meeting them, and organizing these festivals together to make sure that each one is really specialized and focused on that particular context, that we're not just coming in and saying X, Y, and Z would be a good activity, but they can say, well, this is how the situation is here, this is this would be a good way to bridge the gap, because this is what the gap is between those locals. And as I say, the whole thing will be filmed into a documentary. We'll also be hoping to interview activists, NGOs, politicians, and local residents along the route, so that as well as these roots festivals, we can be getting a kind of global picture of the refugee situation throughout Europe. And we hope that can be a good educational tool as a film that we can provide later down the road for people who weren't with us on the journey but want to experience it.
Another important aspect of civil society's work is the integration of asylum seekers and migrants into their new home. Germany has a comprehensive process for integration, but one organization says housing, language, and cultural courses just aren't enough. You need to make people feel like they belong. Anna Maria Olsen launched Give Something Back to Berlin in 2013. She tells us more.
We're using different projects to reach different communities because you can't reach all people through one thing. So for instance, like the Open Arms Shelter, it's a project where we work a lot within the refugee shelters and the camps to kind of mobilize and create a connection with more vulnerable and like hard to reach communities like women and children, that we then notice that they wouldn't show up on our more like public events that we're doing outside. So that's also like a very important part of our work, that like for some groups, like they need a fast access to the to the wider community and like to the city, but with other groups you kind of need to work where they are and to build them up there to then that they will feel secure to start attending other events. And but Open Arms Shelter, it's kind of it's combining kind of psychosocial work like trauma therapy with different types of art, different types of creativity, but like really on a very, in German you say ungezwungen, like there's no goal always, like with the events are just to like coming together, being together, having a space where you're not put under pressure, where you don't have to like, I don't know, perform, because also migrants and refugees, like you're constantly judged, you're constantly, you know, you have your courses, you have like all your paperwork, like you have to prove yourself all the time. So just creating spaces for being together, for dealing with emotional things going on, stress, sorrow, happiness, then doing that through different types of culture and arts, which often then can use and work as a kit where there's no language, you know, like you there might not be a common language for a lot of those people yet, because they haven't learned German or they don't speak English. So So art then can create this little space and actually doing things together and connecting things over, connecting people over actually doing things together.
What kinds of challenges have you faced or continue to face working with refugees?
Well, there's a lot of challenges and there's a lot of joy and there's a lot of potential. But I think one of the main challenge is that, like, how integration is perceived in, you know, in the political discourse and, like, from policymakers and stuff. And what we are doing is, like, a very grassroots-driven kind of soft integration that I think is a lot of politicians, a lot of money givers, they don't understand it because, again, they're obsessed with this type of really measurable sort of impact. So, for instance, like we don't do like for instance like traditional mentoring projects, like because. Yeah, like when you come in, you come into our network, we don't put you together with one German person to become your German friend, because that can be a bit like patronizing and it's like creating this kind of weird dynamic. It doesn't have to do, but we know from experience that it can do. But a mentoring project like this is sort of very easy to kind of track, like you have those 20 people going into this mentoring project or this while we then just act as this huge community and network, and you with like hundreds of people involved like every week, you know, and but that is then hard to track, so to say. Or much harder than 20 well-educated guys from, I don't know, the urban areas of Damascus learning how to, I don't know, start a startup. So this is the question of soft integration and what really makes a person belong and become a citizen of their new... of their new city and country. That's something that that is challenging for us. But then of course, like you have all the, you know, you have post-traumatic stress among the community. You have the enormous isolation that people still face when they live like in you know, big shelters. I mean, yeah, but that's quite obvious things, but it also, it could be easier to work with those challenges if the understanding from the political side was bigger.
How does the German public feel about your work, and how do you engage them in it?
We had very good feedback. No, I mean, in the beginning, when we started 2013, our model was a little bit weird for some Germans. They were, because what we do, one of our main things that we do is that we make migrants volunteer in other local social projects. So, and in the beginning, it could be like, why, what could possibly migrants contribute with, you know, or... And so this was a little bit in the beginning like weird, like that migrants wouldn't have skills and knowledge and energy and curiosity when they come, but so that was one of our first kind of things that we noticed. But we were also becoming sort of like a darling project because we were one of the first who worked so broadly and was like really engaging a lot of different communities in our work. But of course, like we have to answer a lot of stupid questions and narratives. We're working very hard to change narratives around migrants and refugees, but that's also like a part of the job. And also because we are mixing, all our volunteers are mixed, like there's not one single project where there's only Germans helping refugees, but there's like the teams are always like really multinational and multicultural. So there's always someone Syrian in there. There's always someone, you know, with a Muslim background, like different languages, Russian, French. So, and then mixed with Germans, so to say. So that way also the Germans are sensitized for and maybe get a broader view over the whole question of migration.
How do you as an organization fit within the wider German response to refugee newcomers?
The Germans are very obsessed with the hard types of integration. And with the hard types of integration, I mean like German course, I mean, you know, getting a roof over your head, like getting in a, stuff like that, housing. And that's very important things, of course, but it's just the start. And it's nothing, in our opinion, that first you should get your German course and housing, and then you can start, you know, with the more the cultural integration, the, you know, finding belonging, finding hope, finding friends and network, but they have to run parallel. Yeah, it is problematic because it's sometimes I have the feeling that Germany thinks that if you tick all the boxes, like if you learn German first and if you find housing, then it's kind of like the integration is done. But that's really not how we see it. But like making citizens of people and, you know, making active, you know, members of the society, you don't fix that with just sending people to a German course or even whatever they call like integration courses where you're supposed to learn about the German history, you know, like it's with being together with other people, you know, learning, sharing, being out there in the society, connecting with not being segregated, that this is actually happening. And yeah, so there's a change of mindset that needs to change the next couple of years.
Economic access and empowerment are two obstacles that drove one migrant woman in Malta to form her own organization. Umema Elamin is originally from Sudan, and she formed the Migrant Women's Association in 2015. Arriving in Malta, she found her challenges finding work and being independent were shared by many other migrant women. Today, her organization targets the problems that this diverse community face and tries to find solutions.
Can you believe my this organization, Migrant Women Association, it comes from my needs. Because when I come here to Malta, my husband who looking for the children and everything, but at the same time, I try my best to find the opportunity to work, and I didn't find any opportunity to work, or it is, we can say, unsuccessful. Until I get involved in volunteer work, and through volunteer work, I met many people that they are activists in, and they try to guide me to find the way that I can help, and at the same time, I can find some way to help me at the same time. So I met, for example, Claudia from Tellerson, from SOS, chief executive for SOS. She guided me to build this platform of migrant women, because I spoke with her about the channel I face it and how I didn't have access to labor market until now. She told me, Mama, if you can build platform for migrant women, you can see this problem and you can start thinking how you can overcome as group, not you only. And from this point, we start thinking about building platform for migrant women, and gradually until we founded Migrant Women Association. So the main issue of migrant women, to help migrant women, to empower migrant women and help them to integrate with Maltese community. This is the channel I face it as Umaima, you know, because you can't integrate unless you have financial independent, you know, and that's something still we work on it to help migrant women to have opportunity to have access to the labor market, empower them, and at the same time integration with migrant, with Maltese community.
What sorts of things do you help empower migrant women with?
First of all, to be honest, as Migrant Women Association, we start to find out what's the problem. And for that reason, we start with doing research to find the obstacles and barriers that face migrant women to have access to the labor market. According to these barriers and according to these obstacles, we start our planning. For example, we found communication is a huge channel for most of the migrant women to have access to the labor market. Most of them, they don't know English or for example, they find difficulty even to communicate in Maltese. For that reason, we start with communication session or English courses in improving their English conversation. At the same time, for example, we found some women, they have high skills or high qualification, but at the same time, they don't know how they can start their process or procedures to get involved in labor market. We try ourselves now to help them. So most of our project is related to help migrant women according to the outcome of the research.
Can you give me an idea of how many women you actually help here?
Until now, we target almost 40 women, okay? But it depends help how we help them. For example, English lesson, we have 30. But we have another, for example, cooking project. When I spoke about cooking, we have an idea too, because one of the results of the research is related to the skills that migrant women. We found many women, they have skills in cooking, but they don't know how to start. Even we guide them to go to Job Plus and to get certificate for handling food, to understand how they can build, but gradually. So the total, almost 40 women until now.
Within a few months of the creation of Migrant Women, a new project was just emerging. Spark 15 focuses on young refugees, and it tries to find ways to integrate them into Maltese society. Mohamed Hassan is one of its founding members, and he says it started to give young refugees a voice.
The educated young refugees start to increase, especially at the campus of Temkast, and we thought of doing, since we know how NGOs works, and most of us have been volunteering with other NGOs, we thought of something that was missing and in other NGOs, which is the authentic voice, the actual voice of refugees. And we thought of creating our own NGO that will representing the voice of refugees.
Can you tell me more about your campaigning on youth refugee and migrant access to education and jobs?
First, there's no clear policies for young refugees to continue their education. I'm talking about college and I'm talking about university and tertiary education. The lack of policies, also the lack of training from the Job Plus, for example, if we're talking about employment. Plus, if you go back a bit to 2008, this country doesn't have even an integration policy, so naturally it will be difficult for all of us, including the locals. You understand it? So the clear policies in education and employment will be harder to create if you don't have an integration policy. So everything is connected, like you can see the big web.
What lessons would you offer other civil society organizations working with refugees and migrants?
So first lesson is that there is no successful movement without adding the refugee themselves on the board. You cannot speak about refugees as much as you can. You cannot just speak about someone without making him in front as well. Half of the, if not all, half of the NGOs here, they don't have a refugee board member. That's the, and what I understood is that if you add more refugees, the more that you understand the struggle. The other thing is that youth has been very supportive, and they need to be they need the platform to make their voice heard.
Finally, when you look for pictures of the current migration crisis, you get people captured at different stages of the journey, but it's only at face value. Luxembourgish journalist Frédéric Bouc wanted to go deeper. With the help of photographer Sven Becker, her project I'm Not a Refugee explored the people and their stories through individual portraits. It's helped connect refugees with their local community and an international audience of over 60,000 people.
I met and interviewed asylum seekers and recognized refugees. All sorts of background: a doctor, lawyer, stonemason, students, journalists, mothers, teachers, from Syria, Iraq, Somalia, Eritrea, or Palestina. Some of them were very angry when I interviewed them, very angry at the Luxembourgish government because they had the feeling no one was caring for them. They had the feeling the government forgot them. And this is because the refugee status obtention procedure can be very long. Asylum seekers who wait for their refugee status are generally in huge distress. They feel like their life is on hold, they can't make any plans, they feel totally powerless. So the anger was quite strong. Today, 12 months later, most of the people I interviewed are doing much better. Most of them have found a job and a place to stay. Most have met a lot of people supporting them. Most have gained independence. Others are still waiting for their status and are feeling very down.
What did you discover doing this project?
It's ended now after I published 20 online portraits and edited the I'm Not a Refugee book. We managed to connect many people. I am developing other projects related to migration and displaced people. I discovered that civic engagement is an incredible social inclusion driver. Each resident can make a significant change to a displaced person. It is striking how quickly people emotionally connect. It takes like half an hour sometimes for total strangers to connect. It is always amazing to witness how easy it is to create bonds. I learned that what newcomers really lack beside work and a place to stay is a network. Residents have connections, a huge network, especially in Luxembourg, as it is a very small country. I witness this every day, how residents support refugees by offering their friendship in the first place, but also by introducing them to our society, supporting them in their studies, in their search for a job and a place to stay. Human bonds are at the core of integration. I learned that money can help, of course, but can never replace the power of human relations and emotional bonds.
And how was it received?
As soon as we started publishing the portraits, the feedback was really strong and mainly positive. I was surprised actually when the portraits got viral on the social media, especially on Facebook. I got also so many emails thanking me for sharing the stories. And also I got some hate messages. We also do have some right-wing extremism in Luxembourg. Some persons I interviewed received dozens of emails and contact offers to meet up, even job offers. Today we have 5,700 followers on our I'm Not a Refugee Facebook page, which is really impressive for Luxembourg. And it's not only about thousands of likes, our followers' engagement is also very strong. Some portraits are shared or commented hundreds of times. It is a huge satisfaction and joy to be able to make people meet who under normal circumstances never would have met. All in all, most of the people I interviewed are better off today as last year. Time is an important factor in integration. Of course, the main step for each person is the government's acceptance of the refugee status. This procedure can take very long. Interestingly, some refugees didn't like the slogan, "I am not a refugee," telling me that they are refugees. And even when I told them, "Yes, of course you are, but you are also much more," they wouldn't understand. it is clear that the word refugee is dividing refugees. While some hate it, others cling to it. I can understand both.
So that brings us to the end of part one of our exploration of people and organizations making a difference to the lives of refugees and migrants. So far, we've seen how people accommodate refugees and migrants, as well as how they get access to society and ways to change how they're seen and heard. In the next episode, we're going to continue exploring civil society organizations. We'll find out about the kinds of problems they encounter and how food can be a way of connecting communities. Until then, you can follow us on our social media. Check out our latest updates on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and Audioboom. Or you can support our rescue missions by giving whatever you can to help save lives at sea. If you like this podcast, don't forget to hit like, comment, and subscribe for more podcasts from us. From all of us here at MOAS, goodbye.